Live from Burbank, California, where Jesus talked with the animals. It's the Mark Maron Show.
Thank you, Jim Earl. Little Jimmy Earl.
Hey, how you doing, man?
I feel great, buddy. How are you out there, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives? How is everybody? We got a great show planned for you people tonight. We planned it today in my garage. That's where all the big work gets done, in my garage, out behind my house. I got a guy there right now, Jim, building a gate. I'm building a fortress.
Building a wall?
I'm bunkering in.
You're protecting your border?
Yeah, I'm protecting my border. I've got, I'm going to order, you can get these Lou Dobbs scarecrows.
I heard about them.
Yeah, that you can just put along the border of Mexico. That seems to be the new idea, is where the Minutemen can't stand in. They just get a picture of Lou with that look on his face. He frightens people just by his seriousness.
Nothing more frightening than a bad comb over.
A bad comb over and a guy that's looking at you very judgmentally as if he's presenting the truth, as if only the truth is what he calls it. That's what I'm saying. Today we got a good show for you. I already mentioned that. We've got, in just a couple minutes, we'll talk to playwright Peter Morris, whose play opened in New York last night. It's called Guardians. It's actually a play based on some of the incidents at Abu Ghraib and torture in general. Tony Hendra will be here to talk with us about his new book in just a few minutes. Actually, more than a few minutes, probably about an hour. The Messiah of Morris Avenue. Tony Hendra, of course, one of the satiric greats of modern comedy, my friend, from the original Lampoon, from The Lemmings, from Spinal Tap. New York Times reporter Shyla Dewan, who was in New Orleans when I was there, actually, last week. She's been covering New Orleans quite a bit since Katrina, talking to people down there and dealing with what they're going through. We're going to talk to her in just a little while. But, you know, a lot happened in the world today, and we don't want you to get caught off guard or uninformed here at the Mark Maron Show. So here's tonight's short order news. The White House today angrily denied a report in the Washington Post that suggested President Bush knowingly lied about the existence of biological weapons laboratories in Iraq. On May 29, 2003, Bush hailed the capture of two trailers in Iraq as mobile biological laboratories and declared, quote, "We have found the weapons of mass destruction," end quote. Later, the White House claimed that what Bush meant to say was, "We have found two trailers of metal construction." After 43 years on the run, Bernardo Provenzano, the alleged boss of all bosses of the Sicilian Mafia, was arrested by Italian police officers in a farmhouse near Corleone. Coincidentally, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It took 43 years to catch the Mafia boss, or that's about half the length of the movie Scorsese's going to make about him. By half the length of time.
Long film.
Yeah, very long film. Thanks for clearing that up. I like it when you point. Sometimes people are out there and they're like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And Jim, you're there to
I'm the joke scientist.
To counter that. Yeah. Land that was once owned or belonged to Ed Gein, the murderer whose story inspired the movie Psycho, was pulled from an online auction on eBay. Serial killer Ed Gein was arrested when authorities found the headless body of a woman hanging in his home. When asked to explain, Gein gave his now famous answer, quote, "You mean that headless woman?" End quote. Yeah, that's the Mark Maron Short Order News for today. Stay with us. We'll do it again later, but with different jokes. How do you like that, huh?
Woo!
Hey, people, you wouldn't think that the events of Abu Ghraib and the publication of fake torture photos in British papers would inspire someone to write an empathetic and funny play, but Peter Morris has done just that with his play Guardians, which opened last night at the Culture Project in New York City. He's on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show, Peter Morris.
Hey, Mark.
Thanks for joining us. You know, I've read the... I'm dying to see your play. Could you fly me out, please, and maybe I'll take a look?
I'll do my best. It is off Broadway, so you'll have
okay.
to fly.
I'll fly myself. I should be out there soon. How long is it going to be running for?
Right now, we're running through the end of May, May 25th.
Okay. So now, why don't you tell my audience and myself exactly? Like, I've read the press. It's getting great press. It's a very provocative show. But tell me exactly what it's about and what it's based on.
Well, I guess what happened. What the basic idea is that. I was in England.
Mm-hmm.
I was in London when the Abu Ghraib story broke.
Mm-hmm.
2 days later, one of the daily papers in London publishes photos of English soldiers doing the same thing. It was in the Daily Mirror, which was the biggest circulation anti-war paper in England.
Okay.
And then basically what happened was, as America is responding to Abu Ghraib over the next 2 weeks, the English press exposes the English photos is a hoax, takes down the editor of the paper.
I remember this. I remember that happening. They were staged, right? And they all of them were completely staged.
Yeah, they were, although the funny thing is, no one was ever prosecuted for faking them. They couldn't figure anything out. And so now the editor is sort of hinting that maybe they were real.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he lost his job.
Wow. So I thought the conversation around them, if I'm recalling correctly, that if they were real, they were not from Iraq.
Yeah, that was the British government did prove that.
Right. Because of uniforms or something.
Yeah,
some,
serial numbers on a truck and stuff like that.
Geological inconsistencies. I don't remember. So you are confronted as a playwright with the realities of Abu Ghraib and the falsehoods of this propaganda that was put out by the left. And obviously Abu Ghraib sort of was a powerful image to all of us and really changed the way everybody saw the war. Now this sort of got into your head, and then it became what? How did you see your characters? There's only two characters in the play, yes?
Yeah. One is an American prison guard, sort of loosely based on Lindy England, but mm-hmm. there were several female guards at Abu Ghraib.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is just a London journalist, and not really specifically based on anyone, or I wouldn't admit it if it were.
Okay. Okay. You don't want to make too many enemies in the print business.
Yeah, exactly.
And they are in what's the situation? Is it sort of a kind of a hyper-real landscape like Beckett, or are they somewhere?
Well, basically, I just haven't... they're just talking directly to the audience. It's just monologues. Because, I mean, to me, that's the most exciting way to try to deal with issues in a theater is to have the audience there sitting in judgment, trying to figure out what they feel. I mean, I'm not trying to give anybody answers. I don't have them.
Yeah, I don't either. Every time I get one, I find that it's off and it's not very satisfying.
Well, exactly. And anyway, these days, I think if you go around suggesting you do have answers, the administration will come after you, whether they torture you to get them or not.
Right. Well, I guess that's what leads me to my next question. I mean, what do you sort of explore in terms of the British U.S. matrix governmentally and culturally? I mean, how critical are you of these administrations of Blair and Bush in the play, or is that sort of left to the audience to decide?
Well, I try to keep out of it. I mean, but the one thing that I want to be accurate about is, mm-hmm. I mean, for example, the anti-Americanism of the general English population is something that I've felt there when I go over there to work.
Really? Because they go, "Damn Yank, get out!"
Yeah, basically. I mean, I'm sure it's always been there on some level, but now it's really ugly to think that this, which is ostensibly our closest ally,
mm-hmm.
that they hate us that much there. I mean, God knows what it must be like.
You know, it's interesting to me that it seems that the governments actually don't mind that too much. The more I read about the alignment between Blair and Bush and the British government and the American government in terms of oil and imperialism, they really are on the same page. And I just don't think that – I think that someone like Tony Blair would much rather the British population hate Bush than him.
Yeah, exactly. Although this Iran thing that's just breaking now is going to be fascinating.
Now, did you was the play written and done, you know, by the time the bombings took place?
Yeah. In fact, the play opened about 3 weeks or so after the bombings in London.
And in terms of, I read in some of the reviews that there is an element of comedy to this, and that it is empathetic and it sort of humanizes, I'm assuming, Lindy England. How do you go about doing that? Would you call this a satire, or is it a dramatic play?
Well, it's kind of satirical. I mean, just because, or it has humor in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's the easiest and the best job in the world for a playwright is to take someone along the lines of Lindy England. Everyone in your audience pretty much has their mind made up that she's something less than human. And some kind of monster.
She's kind of funny looking, and that doesn't help things. Yeah.
But then all you got to do is you got to say, "Wait, hold on. Let's step back and look at this as a person."
Yeah,
what was motivating her? What would motivate somebody in that position?
No, I understand that. I think that's one of the great powers of comedy is that it enables people to see even the worst of people as humans. It doesn't deny the fact that they did something wrong or they may have been evil, but it does show that they are human beings and humans are capable of doing this.
Yeah, and that's really what you want to. I mean, you know, there's not even any need to name names if you can just show that certain things are capable of happening these days.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you never want to hear somebody take it to a really whacked out degree, like, hey, come on, Hitler was a vegetarian. You know, I mean, how bad a guy could that guy be? Quickly before we end up here, tell me about the Culture Project a little bit and why you chose to go with them.
Well, you know, they're one of the places in New York that, one of the only places really, that is doing political theater. And they have an audience for it. And mm-hmm. it's an exciting range of things they did. I guess the two things that really had caught my attention were they did a play called The Exonerated, which was testimonies of people on death row.
Yeah, I talked to those people. That was intense stuff.
Yeah, that was amazing. And the Culture Project did that, and it sort of took everybody by surprise in New York because, mm-hmm. you know, we're kind of used to Neil Simon here, and then all of a sudden somebody's using the theater for something that it should be used for.
I think Neil Simon doing Abu Ghraib would be hilarious.
You
just make it all Jewish people from Brooklyn. Shut that dog up. It's driving me crazy. Listen, Peter, I just realized as we were talking that some of those photographs you were talking about, the fraudulent photographs, on some level could be considered political theater.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, they're certainly staged.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck with the show, and I hope I can get back to see it. It's at the Culture Project. I got to get a link to the Culture Project up on the site by the end of the day, and it was nice talking to you.
Thanks, Mark. It was
okay,
great talking to you.
Take care.
Okay.
That was Peter Morris. His play Guardians is open in New York at the Culture Project. If you're flying out there in the area, I'm going to go see it. We'll be back momentarily with some talking. Stay with us.
And now he lives in the Enchanted Broccoli Forest, Mark Maron.
I need to get back to the Enchanted Broccoli Forest, Jim Earl. I need to get back there.
I can show you the way.
I know you can. I'm wandering. I'm wandering in the world of bad food. I'm trying to get back. My trip to New Orleans, it was bad, good food. But I'll tell you, the guilt from that trip in terms of my, as I said last night, obsessing about the food, obsessing about my weight, and being in the middle of the realities of what New Orleans is right now, has led me on a sort of personal quest. Though I was reading the blog. If you want a blog, you can go to markmaron.com. And You Be Normal, one of the guys who's on there, he came to the show. A couple of bloggers came to the show down in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And they said that is exactly really what people should do, is come to New Orleans.
Yeah.
To help in any way possible, or just to help, you know, make them feel that, not even make them feel, New Orleans is still New Orleans. And I'll tell you one thing. I read this article today. Almost everyone's running for mayor in New Orleans, but I could not believe that St. Bernard Parish, this is a part of the town that 26,000 homes were destroyed in that part of the town, and that this part of the town, St. Bernard's Parish, was thinking about hiring Michael Brown, ex-FEMA head Michael Brown's consulting company, to help them rebuild. I can't even begin to understand why they would even consider doing it. The guy's a bungling idiot. He's a pathological narcissist. He is not only incompetent, but even after the fact, even after those videos were released and you saw him telling Bush, this is the big one, this is going to be the worst one of all, it does not dismiss his responsibility in the situation. And I think, see, I went the conspiracy route on this one. I thought, you know, St. Bernard's Parish, you're sort of a Catholic undertone, that maybe this is a way that Michael Brown is seeking his redemption. Perhaps if he went to St. Bernard's Parish, was hired, and he could help them rebuild, that somehow it would erase his sins for destroying an entire city or being partially responsible for doing that. But I think I'm reading too much into it, because as I wrote up on the blog, I really think that the only way that he should be allowed to enter New Orleans in any capacity is if they apply a different type of Catholicism to him, maybe a more medieval type, and take him up into one of those attics in St. Bernard Parish, put him in an Iron Maiden or get the cat with nine claws and just, you know, beat the truth out of him and then make him work for nothing for a few months until the town is back up on its feet. I just can't stand that doughy-faced douchebag, and I think he's completely incompetent. Every time I look at him, I know exactly what kind of person he is.
But he did have some experience. He had, you know, relatively speaking to other Bush appointees, he had kind of experience in what he was supposed to do.
He had experience as a failed Arabian horse guy association. But the bottom line is, in my head, is that all he cared about, and when I read his emails and when I saw the way he presented himself and the way he presents himself to this day, is this is a person that only cares about his reputation, only cares about himself, was preoccupied with how he looked on television, with his presentation to the people. Not at any point during the tragedy, the disaster that he was supposed to be managing, did you get the feeling from the behind-the-scenes evidence that the guy cared anything about anything other than himself? It seems to me that if you're going to be working for a company that is in emergency management, that you must have at least some empathy, some compassion. And to this day, I never get the feeling that that guy can see past himself or really cares about helping people.
You see, I think that description, more accurately describes President Bush than it does Brown in this case, because records were released more and more afterwards, it showed him pressing Bush that this is going to be a disaster, sitting there doing nothing.
I'm not arguing the fact that President Bush is a pathological narcissist and that he is only preoccupied with himself and is almost delusional. I'd say delusional and narrow-minded. But that does not dismiss the sense, even if he told President Bush, I mean, FEMA should have been prepared on some level to deal with the disaster just in terms of mobilizing aid. I mean, I talked to people down there, and I know on the state level there's responsibilities there, but they couldn't even get water to people.
But Brown, see, this is exactly what Brown was telling Bush over and over and over again in those tapes, those released videotapes, that FEMA was neutered in the previous budget cuts and everything, and he was telling Bush this.
Yeah, but Dave, I think you're drinking the Kool-Aid, because I think that to me, any indication that these guys are dispersing blame or dismissing their responsibility from it is usually crap. That's what I believe, that's all they do is they try to move blame around it. And who's responsible? The people that live there? It's 33. Why am I trying to say the time? What time is it? Here we go. We'll be back in a second. We're going to talk to Tony Hendra in a few minutes. Stay with us.
Now he's cholesterol's biggest enemy, Mark Maron.
Oh, yeah, I am. Thank you, Jim. You're listening to the Mark Maron Show. If you want to blog with the people, go to markmaron.com. That's markmaron.com. Continuing our conversation, this is the reason why I'm having Shyla Dewan on later. She's a New York Times reporter who just wrote a piece. You can link to it at markmaron.com. Who just wrote a piece about the body collecting that still goes on in New Orleans and about what is happening there on the ground, how people are dealing, is that I don't care whether or not, you know, I'm perfectly willing to blame George Bush for everything because I see most of it as being his responsibility. But after working in a corporate structure for the first time in my life, that being the office in New York, or I don't know if all corporate structures are like that or how corporate culture works, but it seems to me the way executive privilege and the way executive power operates is that if something goes wrong in a corporate hive situation, what the immediate thing is to figure out who the hell to blame for the problem. And a lot of guys or a lot of people in corporate situations are political enough to protect themselves from that and to watch their flank as they are getting into trouble. And that's part of their skill, is to make sure none of the crap sticks to them. And I just saw in relation to Katrina, in relation to Michael Brown's role in it, that anybody who takes – I have found this to be true in my life and in the life of working in a corporate situation. If somebody takes initiative, if they have the courage to take the initiative and try to make something happen that they really care about, then that means not being afraid that you will be blamed. I think most people in corporate structures walk around 90% of their effort is just trying to stay out of the way and not get blamed so they can continue to move up in their career and move to the side. So I believe that if somebody takes initiative because they have courage, that they can go ahead and get things done. If they aren't afraid that it's going to fail, or if they aren't afraid that that they're going to be seen as wrong, they will do it. And I think that if he was to, when he was the head of FEMA, if he were to organize and make sure on a state level things were happening properly, that would have taken emails, phone calls, just a bit of networking and politicking. But I think after the fact, anything that guy says in terms of whose fault it was, I don't give a crap. I just don't care.
But he did email. He did email, and he did talk to Bush directly when it was possible.
I'm not talking about Bush. I'm not talking about Bush. I am talking about the people that could facilitate response on the ground. I'm not talking about going up and getting okays. I'm talking about saying, hey, do we have trucks? Hey, can we get water to these people? Is there any way, you know, the National Guard was in Iraq or dealing with national security issues. That may or may not have been the case. But the bottom line is, just on an organizational level, if you have a city, now, if the city's going to take responsibility for some of this, that's fine. But if you have a city where you can't even get people water, where you've got to rely on the good hearts of people who have boats and people who care about other people to deliver food and water to people, he could have had a network in place if he was so damn concerned about it without getting the okay from Bush. He could have just done his damn job with some courage and some guts, as opposed to, you know, saying, well, they're not giving me anything. What does it take to mobilize people on the ground?
I also remember the corporate structure at, you know, where we used to work, and there were competent people who tried to talk to people in charge, and they risked their jobs for it.
Yeah.
And some of them aren't there anymore because of it. And I think it's very, very hard to, you know, decide whether or not you're going to keep your job and try to do some good by keeping it, or just risk your whole career. Just take all these retired military people coming out now when they can and saying something about how screwed up the war is, and they were too afraid to do it. And there's still probably a myriad of people in the military too scared to say anything about the war because they'll be out.
And yeah, but they'll be out, and a lot of them are looking for a future. Not a lot of them, but many of them, even like what we talked about yesterday, you've got high-level military officers or army officers, guys who are going in as officers, educated. I don't mean high level, West Point, top notch, going in and looking to get out because they can make more money in the private sector. Mm-hmm. I read an article yesterday about a group of Navy sailors who got mail order brides or married foreign women to get more money. The truth of the matter is these vets, a lot of them, when they're in active duty, are not treated right, and it's not even a matter of political opinion, a political ideology. A lot of these guys are seeing a way out through the private sector because it seems to me that war in and of itself is going to be privatized, and the American military is just going to be in a management position of manning bases and looking after resources. But the thing about Michael Brown, getting back to this, is that I saw that guy as an opportunist. I saw that guy who was put into a position because he had a buddy in the game that he had no intention in his life of having that position, and it was just a way to get in. And he acted out. He acted in the way of a guy who just got in and was doing as little as possible to get by. I just don't think, whatever you say, I'm perfectly willing to blame the federal government. I'm willing to blame Bush, but I'm not willing to let Michael Brown off the hook just because he asked for help.
Well, I see him as one of the lesser demons who is kind of redeeming himself in a slight manner by going against Bush and pointing out all the errors that Bush made.
That takes real courage right now to go against Bush.
Well,
a guy who's got a 32 or 38% approval rating. Half the Republicans in the world are going against Bush because it's the only way they can salvage their political careers. I guess he can still
make a huge living being a lobbyist or anything else.
He's going to make a living.
Loser schmucks are going to
I think that that's the reason why Michael Brown is going to the St. Bernard Parish. That's the reason why he is making his services available, is that he wants to be redeemed.
My question is, if he's so virulently hated by everyone who was hurt by this whole thing, why is St. Bernard Parish taking him in like
this? It's just one guy. It's the parish president, this guy Henry Jr. Rodriguez. He believes that if they had Brown in place, that they could use him in the same way that he dropped the ball with Katrina. They could use him to navigate through red tape to facilitate action on a governmental level to get help to the parish. But most of the people, the state senator and some other people, are like, what, are you crazy? This guy, you know, you just show his face around New Orleans, or people like, oh, my God, get that out of here. I can't even look at that guy's mug. So it's really just—it's not a big amount of support he's seeing there, but it's just a few people. And I will talk to Shiloh. I can't now. I'm going crazy because I can't. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right. I guess we'll find out, and I'll be either vindicated or reprimanded for mispronouncing her name. She's been writing for the New York Times for a long time. I met her in New York many years ago. She does great stuff. She's really great with kind of in on the beat reporting. Like, she did a piece about gun running, and she's good. She's been spending time with people on the ground, not writing from an airplane or writing from other news stories. She's down there. She's talking to people who have lost their homes. They've lost relatives, and she's got a pretty good perspective on it. I don't know why I get so worked up. I swear to God, my time in New Orleans really tweaked my head, because partially because of my own selfishness. But there is other things to talk about. The guy who's building my gate, it's interesting how people think. He used to be a Marine, and I had a brief conversation about him once before. He was a Marine under Reagan, and I brought up, I said, Iran, because obviously I'm going right to the wacky margin with Iran, in that I completely buy the idea. I'm completely frightened just because one person said it on an email that China is supplied primarily with Iranian petroleum, that if we bomb Iran, that it's the beginning of World War III. So that's where I'm going. In my head, it's the Bay of Pigs. Okay, it's like we're in the world is in trouble, but it's even worse trouble. We could be on the verge of nuclear holocaust. But I asked this guy. I said to him, I said, look, you know, I think we're going to bomb Iran. And he, as a soldier, he said, well, isn't that better than putting troops on the ground?
No.
Well, that's what I said. Well, I would hope that there was a diplomatic avenue that could be taken.
False choice, you know?
Yeah, it is a false choice, but it is not a false choice in the way people think, and I think it's not in the way Americans think. Like we were talking about on the break a little bit, they're setting up Iran to be exactly what Iraq was on some level. They are exploiting people's fears by claiming that just because they enriched uranium, which could be used for, you know, power plants, but they are years away from developing any sort of weaponry. But what they're doing is they're exploiting the fears of the American people, certainly, George Bush is, to the fact that they think Iran is like, you know, 2 days away from shooting bombs over here. Because that's the first thought I had. On top of, well, Bush has got to be lying, is that, well, we don't need nuclear weapons flying over here from there, too, or what could happen to Israel, or what could happen to Iraq, what could happen in that region. But we do have a program in our brain that sort of responds to someone saying nuclear weapons with, like,
Yeah, of course.
So, but the fact that he's playing that card again to justify what might be an invasion, if Seymour Hersh is right, is just politicking, and it's shameless, and it could cost a lot of people their lives and completely destabilize that region. Just so what? So what? People like him? People like Bush again because his approval rating is at 38%? I don't know. So are you angry about anything, Jim? Can we spin the wheel today? Are you ready to spin it?
Yeah, I'm pretty angry about something.
All right, well, give it a spin. And the wheel lands on Passover. Well, this ought to be good. Can I say happy Passover first to the Jews that care?
Sure, why not?
My brother, who is a little bit Jewy, I called him last night. He's like, well, tomorrow's Passover, so I'm not going to be able to do this. I'm like, really, tomorrow? Tomorrow's Passover? I used to like going to the Seders. I used to like going and hanging out with the people and eating the funny stuff. Oh, listen to me trivializing my own people. No, I mean, you know, there's a bone and an egg and some leaves. Oh, see, I'm doing it again. I'm trivializing it again. There's a rattle. Is there a rattle?
Yeah, there was at one place
you
was
put
at.
You put some wine out for a ghost.
Scarecrow.
Who comes. Yeah. Scarecrow.
Oh, wait a minute. That was
no, I wish I was going to a Seder. I'm a little out of the loop on the Jew stuff, and I did like Passover. You get to go find the afikoman. You know what? Tomorrow I'm going to bring a pizza masa in, and you can go find it, and I'll give you a quarter. That's it.
I'll give you a dollar. Just don't bring it in.
No, if you give me five, maybe. But I'll tell you what. I'll bring a piece of matzah in. I'll wrap it in a little cloth and I'll hide it. That's what they used to do. You hide the afikoman. Why are you judging me?
I'm not judging you.
You people on Sunday are going to run around looking for colored eggs. What the hell is that about?
Why can't you do something like hide a donut or something? Hey, I'd go for that.
I'll hide an afikoman. if that'll make you play along with my little Jew game.
I don't do the Easter thing anymore. That was fun for kids, though, going to look for the colored candy and stuff in the backyard.
I'm going to buy me a chocolate bunny and look for eggs. Let's have an Easter party at my house, an Easter Passover party. I'll hide some donuts, and I'll hide some eggs.
Okay.
And you and I will just run around my backyard looking for donuts and eggs.
As long as you got some pot, you know.
I don't have any pot. Do I have to get pot now?
Yeah.
Too?
If you're going to have me over.
Really?
I'm going to get stoned on this Easter.
All right, buddy. So we'll come back and do the Wheel of Anger Passover. This should be good. Is this going to hurt me?
No. It's not going to hurt anybody.
1 second. We'll be back.
And now he keeps a cushion of safety around his body at all times. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. So this Sunday, eggs and donuts in the bushes. We're doing a Passover/Easter bonanza. That's a hot rotted Easter, hot rotted Passover. Hot rotted in the sense that not matzah, we're doing donuts this year. Hiding a donut, drinking grape juice, waiting for the ghost, and talking about the big story. The passing over of the homes of the, you know, the thing. It's Exodus out of Egypt. I know it. Genesis, the whole thing. Look, we got. And now I'm not even standing up for my own people, and you're about to take a big dump on us. I can feel it. You're mad at my people.
I'm not going to take a dump on your people.
Well, that's good. I'm happy to hear that. Well, what do you got? Let's do this Wheel of Anger thing.
Well, okay.
Mark. Spin it? Wait, hold on. Let's spin it. And it's. Cars. It didn't land on Passover.
No, just spin it again. Spin it just a little bit. Over to the Passover thing.
One more time. Just to get
cars.
And it's $5,000. All right, Pat. I'll take. Can I buy a vowel?
This wheel is just not working out.
I know it's a completely different wheel now. We're on television. Go Passover.
Passover.
Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Before I begin, I'd just like to pass this on to you. Dan Pashman found a pair of glasses in a Steve Madden case in the conference room at 6th Avenue. Please see him if you need them. Man, what is wrong with me? Why can't I not get away from that place? Moving on. Uh-huh. Yesterday, while Mark and I were working out a crunch, I raised the question, Mark, what should tomorrow's Wheel of Anger be about? And just as he was squeezing into his undersized body sock to reveal his unsightly camel toe, Mark uttered the now famous phrase, talk about the Jew. I said, what? The Jew, Mark said. Do it on the Jew. It's Passover. Make fun of my peoples. Make fun of their sacred holiday. It will be funny. So here I am, America.
Me and my big mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here I am, America. I mean parts of Los Angeles. Here I am telling you that today I will not make fun of Jews and their pagan rituals. With their crispy flat breads, their soft, large-breasted women, their close-knit families who always yell at each other, with their strange language and penchant for haggling, and Mark Maron's secret desire to be Welsh, I especially will not make fun of Passover, because it's basically this. You tell boring stories, get drunk on cheap wine, and smear lamb's blood on your doorway. Or as I like to call it, Mondays.
Yeah.
Woo! Anyway, does it count if it's human blood? No matter. Because today I will not make fun of Jews and their hilarious beliefs. Because right now there's something even more important to talk about, Mark.
Yeah.
Lori David and global warming.
Oh, man.
As some of you may recall, a few weeks ago, I posed this simple question to Mrs. David. How are we supposed to believe Larry David could ever marry somebody who looks like Cheryl Hines? Man, she tore me apart faster than Jeff Garland ripping into a bucket of chicken.
Oh, no.
Fearing I might have ruined the interview and in the process dampened any chance of Mark pitching himself as Larry's retarded neighbor, I switched the subject to global warming. I merely posed a question intimating that Americans might want to become aware of the rapacious effects their meat-centered gluttony has upon the environment, and over 20% of global warming is caused by meat production. Man, she tore me apart faster than Jeff Garland ripping into a bucket of chicken. That's funnier the second time.
Yeah, I'll say.
According to
Hold on, let me process it. I'm still laughing.
Yeah. Can you see the image? Jeff Garland just ripping into a bucket of chicken.
Yeah, I can.
Like a rabid tiger.
Do you want me to do my morning zoo laugh for it?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Spin the wheel again. Yeah. Okay, anyway. That's, you know what? Where am I? Man, she tore me up. Oh, I already did that. According to her, I was setting a, quote, crazy gold standard that no human being can meet.
Mm.
What? That I asked a crazy, destructive question. Well, I've seen your global warming website, Lori. Asking me to unplug the charger to my Snoopy toothbrush will destruct my teeth. And I know how putting glaringly harsh industrial low-energy light bulbs in my tiny apartment and unplugging my rock polishers are important steps towards saving the world. But isn't it time your website talked about the bigger dangers to the environment, like the American diet? In conclusion, America, tonight when you fly home to your mansions and your private jets and unplug those cell phone chargers, why not go one step further and unplug your colons with a healthy, earth-loving vegetarian diet? I recommend eggplant. And that's why Passover is so hilarious. You've just taken a ride on my wheel of anger. I'm Jim Earl, and you've been Earled.
So, it's weird. I think it's important that you finally exercise. Was somebody pestering you to do this, saying, like, you know, Jim, you can't let that Lori David thing hang because you might have a career in television someday.
No, you know, screw that. I've seen that movie she produced with
Al Gore?
No, with the, what was it, that movie he...
Sour Grapes?
Sour Grapes. Man!
I want to make it clear here.
I'm just kidding. A lot of this is humor, but you know what?
I understand, Jim, but, like, look, on the website, I tried to be vegetarian. Oh, what? Go ahead, tell me about that.
On her website, every one of the action items to help stop global warming and slow it down has to do with unplugging something.
Yeah.
Nothing, absolutely nothing, or unplugging something, or driving slower, or buying a hybrid.
Right.
Nothing is said about deforestation due to meat eating and meat production. And that's almost 20, probably a quarter.
Anything on there about industrial legislation, about legislating toxins and carbon dioxide, carbon fumes into the environment from industry? Anything about that?
Yeah, I think it has, yes.
But nothing about human-induced methane and deforestation.
Animal methane. And ammonia and the aquifers and everything.
All right, buddy.
You know, it's a huge.
All right. Well, maybe she'll call us back. Maybe you've provoked her enough this time that she'll call us back and tell you to shut up. Or maybe she's just going to continue ignoring us. I don't know. You want to go now for a minute? We'll come back and talk to Tony.
I got to calm down.
Yeah, I'll say you do. You're freaking me out. We'll be back with Tony Hendren in a second.
And now, back to an overly defensive driver, Mark Maron.
That's for sure. How's everybody doing out there? Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, lurking conservatives, thanks for being with us. A couple minutes, we're going to talk to Tony Hendren. In a little while, we're going to talk to New York Times reporter, Shyla. I'm really mad that I don't know exactly how to say her name, and I've been saying it all night. I guess we'll find out in a second. I do know that she's not listening right now. Because she can't, but
you can edit.
I know. But she's going to talk to us about New Orleans. She just did a piece with the New York Times, and that tomorrow, buddy. I've been off aspartame for like 2 weeks, my friend.
Woo!
And I've been off nicotine. Well, I'm chewing the gum. I'm clean minded. But Betty Martini from Mission Possible International is going to talk to us about, this is something you don't talk about much, you and your meat. But aspartame is poisoning the people, my friend, making people. Some people who are sensitive to it. To aspartame, they get symptoms like MS, and it goes away if they stop eating aspartame. It's important. I'm excited we're talking to her. Tony Hendren has been part of the satirist community, I guess you could call it that, since the 70s. He was part of the original National Lampoon staff with Doug Kenny, P.J. O'Rourke. He helped create the National Lampoon's Lemming Show. He was in the film Spinal Tap last year. His memoir, Father Joe, was a New York Times bestseller. Now his new book, The Messiah of Morris Avenue, takes on what I call the Christo-fascist zombie brigade. by having Jesus return as Jose from the Bronx, whose disciples are crack whores and drifters. Nice to talk to you again, Tony.
You too, pal.
Hey, man. So I'm very excited someone at least is attacking this commercialized, horrendous, fascistic Christianity in this country.
Well, you make no secret of where you stand, Mark.
You talk a lot. Well, before I get into that, what made you decide? What was the process of figuring out who the Messiah was going to be, and why did you choose Jose?
Well, the genesis of the book, if you'll forgive the use of the word genesis,
uh-huh.
The genesis of the book really came after the 2004 elections, I
uh-huh.
guess. Watching all these guys elected and reelected, preening themselves over this victory they attributed to their supposedly Christian values. And it really came home to me just how far I felt as a now a practicing Catholic and therefore a Christian from these values. I mean, it seemed to me that they had nothing whatsoever to do with Christianity, and so I began thinking at that point of a book which whose premise was actually a premise that I've toyed with satirically over the years quite often, return of the Messiah.
Right, the second coming or whatever it might turn out to be.
Right.
So it seems to me that your characterization, at least the people that are surrounding this Messiah, might have been in contact with Jesus in terms of whores and drifters and people of
absolutely.
That
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's important to set the environment here, which is, my book isn't it's a novel for one thing,
yeah,
and it's it is projected somewhat into the future, but not very long, let's say a decade or so, in which basically the Christian right has taken over. They've achieved all their wildest dreams.
And they've infused themselves into all of culture.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we now live in a church state. The
mm-hmm.
Supreme Court is called the Supreme Court under God.
Oh my God!
Along with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Treasury, there's a Secretary of Salvation.
Uh huh.
And he's this character who's very important in the book called the Reverend James Zebediah Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
And, as the book opens, we are watching him preside over the first faith-based Academy Awards in Hollywood history. Which, of course, is now called Hollywood.
Hollywood.
Right. I mean, this is a world, in which the Justice Department has closed down American Idol for idolatry.
Oh, you know? Thank God. I wish I'd do it this week. I can't take...
But there's a serious... obviously, there's a serious point to this. I mean, it is actually a possibility. And into this quasi-theocracy, I introduce someone who seems to me to be as much in contrast to this power crazy, as you call it, Christian fascist
zombie brigade
state, zombie
yes.
state, who is as far from that as possible, but to me is what that guy who walked around in Judea 2,000 years ago was really about.
So you're exposing the chasm between Christian power mongering and how they dictate culture only to take power of things with what the real message of Jesus you see to be.
Yes, exactly. So my Messiah who might or might not be the Messiah according to the narrator, who's a deeply skeptic journalist. His name is Jose. Everyone calls him Jay. He comes from Morris Avenue in the Bronx. He's poor, and he moves amongst the poor, and his first concern is for the poor, just like the first time.
Yeah.
And he wears a hoodie, and he drives a beat-up GM van, and he played basketball in high school. He's one of us. He's an ordinary guy. He's not the sort of glue, I think, of the Christian right's vision of the second coming is that it will be the Christ will be a kind of Lieutenant J. Christ USMC. He'll come in overwhelming power to mow down billions of Pat Robertson's enemies.
He'll actually
Susan Sarandon and George Clooney and
right.
probably you, Mark.
Yeah, I know. He'll actually Jesus will land in an F-16 on a boat.
Yes, right.
I always wonder about that joke that Lenny Bruce used to do about I think it was Lenny Bruce when he said, yeah, the Jews killed Jesus, and if he came back, we'd kill him again.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's very much the premise of this book. In fact, I mean, although it's a great deal of it is intended to be satirical and funny, it actually has a very serious ending, which unfolds in the way that I think both Christians and non-Christians would expect.
Yeah.
And it actually, I think it was Mark Twain who first said, you know, if Christ came back, the Christians would crucify him.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that they have a... I don't understand. In terms of the way you've meditated on this stuff, you've gone through some religious introspection in your last book, Father Joe, and now with this book. Why do you think it is that people continue to follow these type of this type of Christianity that is so misleading and so clearly a political thing?
Well, it's I'm not sure it's totally a political thing. I mean, I think it's very appealing because it's incredibly simple. It's you read the Bible and it's literally true.
Mm-hmm.
For these folks, which makes it life very 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 easy and simple.
If you can do it, if you can suspend your disbelief.
Exactly. If you just take the leap. And I mean, there are other aspects to it too, which are very appealing, frankly, which is, for example, the rapture. Do you know about the rapture?
Are you kidding? Do I know about it? I think I'm part of it. I think that my presence on the planet is part of the beginning of it.
You're the Antichrist.
I think I'm one of them. I think there were a few of us, and we were given instructions when we were seven by a weird man who came with no face. But I try not to keep that. I got to keep it to myself. Yeah, I know about the rapture. They're all counting on it.
Exactly. But I mean, the thing about the rapture, if you really look at it dispassionately, the thing about the rapture, the great appeal of it is you don't have to die.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
you're going to be snatched up to heaven. You don't have to die. Whole, you know, you go up to heaven, you're saved, boom, you're with Jesus forever and ever.
Well, I do a joke in my act about the fact that the reason the Christian right is so pro-Bush is not because he's a moral guy, it's because he might end the world and they're ready to go.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I mean, from a policy point of view, I think that's probably affecting, you know, the sort of recklessness of the Bush administration has a lot to do with the fact that that they're pandering to people who really do believe that these are the final days.
I once asked a rabbi, though, you know, I have this weird problem that just because something is prophecy, it seems to me that means that it has to happen. I don't feel like it has to happen. It seems that, hey, we could stop it. You know, it's just a book, fellas. I don't understand why they feel like they have to move towards it intentionally.
Yeah, certainly. But that is very much what holds them all together.
Now, in your book, do you? I don't want to give away the ending, and I don't want you to give away the ending. But is there hope at the end?
Well, to be serious for a moment, I mean, when I first thought of this idea, I must say, as I think I mentioned earlier, this is a premise I've toyed with in the Lampoon. You know, I mean, in Lemmings, for example,
sure.
we did a whole sketch which was a takeoff of Jesus Christ Superstar, which was called Jackie Christ Superstar,
yeah.
Which you know, Christ was a comedian who was put to death for telling the wrong kind of jokes. And this is kind of a premise that over the years I've toyed with, as I said. And I guess when I first thought of this, I thought of it really as a sort of straight ahead satirical premise, you know, that the Messiah would come and he would expose the Christian right, and that would be that. A nice, simple,
right.
Sort of nice, simple satirical idea. But unfortunately, when you sit down to write a novel, the characters take over.
Right.
And the Messiah figure, Jose, became very real to me and really shifted the whole direction of the book in a very major way. And I began to realize that if I was going to do this and really sort of start thinking seriously about what I actually did believe and didn't believe, that this guy couldn't just be a cipher. He couldn't just be a device.
Right. Yeah. He had to be a real person.
Yes, exactly. So the book, in fact, I think, becomes very serious in the last third, and a kind of passion unfolds. But I think the best thing is that, at the very end, the villains, the people, the Christians who really turn out to be the anti-Christians,
yeah.
are redeemed.
Oh, well, okay. Well, now, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's the Christian way, isn't it?
Well, it is. You know, Father Joe used to say, there's no us and them. You must understand that, dear.
Oh, man, I got to work on that, Tony.
Yeah.
So the book is The Messiah of Morris Avenue. Tony Hendra, thanks for joining us. Great talking to you again.
You too, Mark.
All right, you take care. So we'll be back. We're going to talk to Shayla. Shayla, I'm so mad at myself, but we're going to talk to her about New Orleans. She was just there. She's a New York Times reporter, and talk about what's going on there. So stay with us.
Now he's loaded with fiber and about to explode. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. I saw you chomping at the bit there to get involved with the talk about religion.
Well, you know.
We're still getting emails about that. Okay, let me. I'm not going to take you to task, but you know, I am an agnostic person, bordering on atheist, but I can't commit to full atheism because that would mean that I would be denied my flights of fancy that I use to rationalize my behavior. I'm not a constantly a rational person. I don't know a lot about science, but I believe in science. But there's still part of me that tends towards the mystical at times. Now, my question for you as a dissenter, as somebody who sees Christianity, I see organized religion as dangerous. I see the mutant manifestation of the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade as being dangerous. But here if you got somebody who has extrapolated some of the teachings of Jesus that they find beneficial and help them become compassionate people or caring people or people that are, think of themselves second, a little more altruistic, some of the things that are talked about as being Jesus-y, and they call themselves Christians, do you say that they're being disingenuous?
Disingenuous? I don't think, I'm saying that they don't really know what a real Christian is. And I think that all religion is basically based on it is evil. It's based on a faith which is horrible.
What about Buddhism?
Faith
huh?
is a belief in something for which there is absolutely no proof. And when you believe something like that, and you believe in an omnipotent, omniscient, all-powerful being, then you can justify anything. It doesn't matter if you're going to say, "Hey, well, Jesus helped the poor." And you know what? He also killed my neighbor for looking over my fence. I'm going to do that, too.
No, I understand that. But if people are let's say that they're not even religious people. They say, oh, I used to be Christian, but some of the stuff that Jesus did has inspired me to open up a hospital and care for sick kids with cancer. Are you going to tell them, you're misunderstanding Jesus?
Well, if they really want to get into that kind of argument, fine. You know, I think what they're doing is great. But, you know, they should probably know that Jesus also, Jesus said at least 9 times in the New Testament that you should follow the letter of the law in the Old Testament, which is probably one of the most brutal,
horrible
instruction booklets on earth.
Stoning.
Mass murder, rape.
So you, yeah. I was just talking about the really bad ones.
I'm a Bertrand Russellite when it comes to religion, which, you know.
Bertrand Russellite, the historian.
Yes.
And
famous
that
peacenik.
Can you encapsulate? Well, let me ask you this. I understand where you're coming from.
Religion is basically, every war has religion behind it.
I understand that. But how do you, because you're, you know, a brittle, cranky, pragmatic guy.
And a lover.
How do you make, you don't rationalize at all? You don't have any type of faith that makes it okay to be you on a day-to-day basis?
Faith? I have a belief in mankind or humankind that there's, you know, people are basically good.
Maybe
I don't have exact proof for that.
That is crazy. That's like saying there's a God.
No, there isn't. And I also,
I'm just arguing with you for the sake of argument. I tend to believe that I want to believe that people are generally good and that people are generally compassionate and innately caring and concerned, and that there are things like religion and politics and national boundaries that put wedges in people's ability to be that. I believe that's true. There are some bad apples, and I've met them. Many of them are in our business, actually.
Yes.
But
you say you're an agnostic. I mean, you see, or, and I say I'm an atheist, but most people don't agree on how to define those terms when they say
here's,
those
here's,
things.
Well, here's what I'll tell you. I don't feel like I'm missing God in my life. I don't feel that there is some sort of... I used to feel that there was some sort of mystical force that was in charge of fate and synchronicity and that that it had time to pay attention to me. But that was only... That's just inverted selfishness. That to think like, you know, oh my God, God just put that 31 flavors in front of me so I could have a daiquiri ice. You know, that's ridiculous. But I don't find myself craving that, but I do understand why people have belief in something bigger than them in order to, you know, fight despair and existential panic. Whatever that may be, you would hope it's a good thing, like you with environmental causes and progressive politics. You would hope that they would do that. So I'm only agnostic in the sense that I don't completely close the door. You know, I don't want to – if something does happen, I don't want to miss it just because I'm closed-minded. That's all. I'm just hedging my bets.
Well, you know, when I say I'm an atheist or agnostic, I mean, I don't think that's being close-minded.
Yeah.
I think you can rely on science to open things up to you if they open up.
Yeah, no, but science doesn't, sometimes it doesn't dance and it's not as poetic as I'd like it to
You're
be.
You're talking about stripping now.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. We'll be back with Shayla doing about New Orleans from the New York Times. And I know this person. That's what's horrible.
And now he's preserved with benzene. Mark Maron.
I said that. Now you're actually hacking my stuff.
Hey, man, I'm not hacking anybody.
I said that. That's a diet soda thing. That's another thing. I'm not, no more aspartame in my diet sodas. I am drinking a Splenda diet soda, but I'm banking on that being a little better, that's not going to make me a moron or cause me neurological damage through toxicity.
Next
I'm hoping.
MSG.
I don't need MSG.
Hydrolyzed yeast extract, that
oh,
is MSG.
Come on, man.
Anytime you see that, that's MSG.
What? Oh, hydrolyzed yeast extract?
Yeah.
Partially hydrogenated vegetable oil is bad, too, and it's in almost every candy that you can eat unless you eat. We'll talk about this tomorrow, okay? I don't, you know, the president's approval rating is now 38% by some polls and even lower by others. And then you get this information out today about him possibly knowing that there was a report by scientists and engineers that the Pentagon contracted to find out about those trailers in Iraq that they call biological weapons trailers, that he might have known when he said that they were biological weapons trailers that they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he knew. I mean, I'm just assuming that all of that information was just crap and he was just lying to us. But yet there is still 38, just the fact that there are still 38% of this country that still believes in this guy is amazing to me. He might as well just come out and said the truth. He might as well just come out before the war and just said, look, we're planning a very extensive new business strategy with the region to consolidate our resources there. Who's on board? Why do you have to lie at all if that many people are still going to buy into his crap at this point in time? But let's move on to other things. As many of you know, I was just in New Orleans, and I felt bad for many reasons. But I did have a good time there, and I don't feel bad about that. I think we've decided that. Shayla Dewan has been reporting on Katrina ravaged New Orleans for a while now. Her most recent article in the New York Times makes clear something that we should all remember is that New Orleans is nowhere near okay. They're still finding bodies, and they are desperate enough in St. Bernard's Parish to even be considering hiring Michael Brown, as we talked about earlier. Shayla is on the phone with us from Atlanta. Hi, Shayla.
Hi, Mark.
Well, I was just down there myself. And I had not been down there. I'd only seen it on television. I did a benefit, and I was in the French Quarter or in the areas that are still functioning. Some of the people down there are calling it the Isle of Denial.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or the sliver by the river.
The sliver by the river. But, you know, people are sort of pounding through and trying to regroup and have and get business up and running. But once you leave that part of the town, that part of the city, it looks completely hopeless to me, and I hear it's much better than it was. Now, do you find that are things starting to move forward? I mean, I know in this article they're still finding bodies. I mean, is there hope?
Well, they had stopped even looking for bodies.
Why?
For several months, so I guess in the sense that they've started looking again, you could say there's progress.
Why did they stop looking?
many reasons, but two main reasons were that the Ninth Ward is full of unstable structures. They're very dangerous, and so you actually need heavy equipment to be able to look through some of these houses. You have to literally take them apart to make sure that there's no one in there. And excuse me. Secondly, FEMA stopped paying for the overtime that the fire department needed to pay people to do that work.
And the city must be pretty compromised financially, I'd imagine, so they probably can't.
No money, and the fire department had no money for overtime, and they made a decision that all of their resources needed to be used in fighting fires.
Now, you know, when I was down there, I talked to a lot of people, and it's interesting that there are some people that I thought were fairly open-minded, liberal people that believe that the Ninth Ward should just be scrapped entirely. And they constantly are talking about, that this is a class issue. But I went to the Lakeview section, and that was an upper-middle-class suburb, and that's devastated. How much of what you're talking about is related to poverty in terms of whether or not they found more bodies in the Ninth Ward or waiting to do it or not doing it?
I think that particular issue is related to just the level of destruction in the Ninth Ward.
Right.
Unlike Lakeview, where houses flooded, 10, 15 feet of water, the Ninth Ward houses were literally just shoved over by the force of the storm surge breaking through the levee. And there are a lot of misconceptions. The Ninth Ward is actually higher than many other parts of the city in elevation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it literally was the faulty levees that destroyed that neighborhood.
Wow. So now, in terms of FEMA, you just said that they wouldn't pay for the fire department to do that. Have they abandoned the city? Have they pulled out?
No. They're still there. In fact, they have a very huge bill coming due as they start paying for public infrastructure to be rebuilt.
Okay.
So they have many, many projects to complete. But
they all make jokes about the blue tarps down there, the FEMA blue. That you get literally flying in, you can just see, hundreds of blue tarps on the tops of houses. So do you know what they have planned for? Well, let's talk about something that you've been reporting on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in terms of the morgues and the bodies and that now FEMA has, what happened with that? Where are they putting the bodies now? And how many are unidentified? How many are still missing?
Well, FEMA first was operating a morgue, impromptu morgue outside of Baton Rouge. Then they decided to build a morgue. They spent $17 million to build a brand new morgue from the ground up in the middle of a field.
Is that the best use of $17 million?
Well, then 8 weeks later, they closed the morgue down.
Oh.
And they said that they closed it down because there was no longer enough volume to justify keeping such an expensive facility open.
Oh, my God. Where's that money going to? See, I can't help but think that these kind of contracts are just, there's payoffs to people, to cronies of the government. Do you think that?
I don't know. I mean, I think we still need to take a close look at a lot of the contracts.
No kidding. Man, they just billed $17 million. So where are the bodies going now?
Well, the ones that were unidentified, which there are not very many left, I think it's less than 200, are being stored in a storage facility in New Orleans, and they are still releasing bodies to families from that place. The new ones that they're finding had been going to a refrigerated truck in Baton Rouge.
They're exporting the bodies?
They were just sending them there for lack of any other place to put them.
Wow.
There's no morgue in New Orleans because the morgue was flooded.
Now, in terms of, rebuilding, I guess I can only speculate, but I couldn't even, there was no way I could have imagined just how devastated everything is in those neighborhoods. Is there any indication of what they have planned for any of the areas? I mean, are they going to rebuild the Ninth Ward? Have you heard anything?
Again, there's so many factors. One is the famous FEMA flood maps that have not come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't know what they're going to be required. Those are maps that will tell people how high their houses need to be elevated,
right,
whether or not they can actually even get insurance in certain places. People are waiting for those to come out. Some people haven't even been home yet to see their houses.
Isn't there 80% of the population still gone?
No, it's about a third of the population is back.
Okay.
But lots of people are still gone. And
wow.
It's a political issue right now because there's going to be a mayoral election at the end of this month. And right now, no one wants to say, you know, we're not going to rebuild your neighborhood. It's
right.
Sort of like 9/11. No one could say during the campaign, you know, gee, the World Trade Center really isn't a graveyard.
Right.
We don't want it to be a graveyard. We want to use it.
It's weird. I got that a sort of similar vibe down in New Orleans in the parts of the city that were functioning as I remember in New York after 9/11, a sort of kind of shock and just deep grief and desire for things to go back to normal somehow.
Yes. I mean, I think many, many people really want to go home. And what a lot of people don't realize is that evacuees have not had a choice about where they're going to live. If FEMA gave you an apartment in Houston for 12 months, that's it. They're not going to then give you another apartment in New Orleans. They're telling people, sorry, we gave you a place in Houston. You got to stay there.
And also, apparently the apartments that are available in New Orleans are skyrocketing in rent because there's so little available.
Yeah, rents have doubled or tripled.
And what about the trailer situation? I saw a lot of trailers just sort of out and about. Like, there were just, like, trailers in parking lots. There were some FEMA trailers, you know, outside of town. But there didn't look like anything organized. But they were just sort of scattered. What's going on with those?
Well, there's two different things. One is that some people have managed to get trailers at their house.
Right,
so
I saw some of that.
Destroyed,
yeah.
You can get a trailer and live in it while you rebuild.
Okay.
Then there are a lot of people who didn't have a house. Or don't want to do that, and some of them are eligible to get FEMA trailers in trailer parks. But, of course, there's lots of debate over where those trailer parks should be placed. People don't want them in their backyards. They don't want poor FEMA evacuees living near them. The mayor recently halted all trailer installation in the city. It's just been another one of those impossibly complicated nightmares.
Now, what about the fear? I guess I don't know really. I'm just sort of talking, you know, off the top of my head here. Now, is there an eminent domain issue? Like, is there a possibility that they will just plow chunks plow homes under and just take that property away from the people that rightly own it to redevelop?
Well, I think that is the eventuality that is very, very unpopular to talk about. So no one, I mean, you have a situation where no one wants to deliver the bad news. That's what's going on right now.
So the bad news could be
that these neighborhoods are not going to be viable. And they've told the neighborhoods themselves this sort of like right of self-determination thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can prove that you're viable, then we'll start picking up your garbage again and deliver city services to you. But if you move back and start rebuilding and you don't have a neighbor for five blocks around you, then guess what? We're not going to give you city services. So, and none of this has been set in stone. These are just different things that have been said.
So they could actually, that's kind of coercive to, you know, to push people out if they want to try to take back their property in a pioneering way.
Well, they won't do that.
Right.
That's one reason why they won't do that. But they've come up with this giant buyout plan, which would, in theory, give people option to rebuild or option to sell their property.
Okay. Well, hey, can we, Shiloh, can we check back with you on this stuff as
sure.
It unfolds?
Yes. It's a slow movie. It's like a Jim Jarmusch movie or something.
Okay. Well, I'll be in touch with you. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Shiloh Doohan from the New York Times. Take care. We will be back with the short order news, some closing arguments. Are we going to argue, Jim? I feel like I'm not done with this religious thing. It's
sure.
Not. I'll talk to you in a minute.
Stay where you are, because I'm looking at you through the bathroom window. Oh, and Mark Maron's Short Order News is coming up next.
Now, he really liked that movie where that thing happened to some guy. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
Mark Maron.
Love that movie.
Yeah, that was a great movie, man.
Yeah, there was a couple movies like that that I really liked.
At that place.
Yeah, at the place where you sit down. I'll tell you this agnostic atheist thing, the science rational thinking thing. I had to fight tooth and nail with my own self not to be a paranoid, mystical thinker. I wrote an entire book about my quest for connection. And now, the only reason I say I'm an agnostic is that I like to think that my cats are magic and have souls and maybe had different lives. I like to maybe believe in poetry and the possibility of something that transcends this mundane, ridiculous planet that we're on. I like the idea of it. I don't search for it. Every once in a while, I'll get a knowing smile and go, yeah, I see, that's why that happened. And I don't attribute it to anybody necessarily, and I know that it might be some trick I'm playing with my own perception. But I have found that if you do not believe that you are in control of everything or can understand everything, if you understand that you will be humbled and perhaps a gracious person filled with empathy. I don't believe that you need God to do that, but I understand why people believe in things that are bigger than them in order to go through their life with a certain amount of peace of mind. Okay?
Well, okay. You know, that fine. That's okay with me. You know, there's a lot of scientific evidence that things go on after, you know, we're gone. And energy-wise, you know, there's a great pool of energy out there in the shape of a big spaceship that's going to come pick us all up. Expecto Patronus.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what the hell I'm talking. You know, there is scientific evidence that you know, there has to be something that survives. Energy cannot be destroyed.
See,
in
now,
that manner is what I'm talking about.
You know, I think we've got to figure out a way to end these shows better because, I mean, yesterday we... I think this energy idea requires a little more.
Well, it's a deep thing.
Can I, real deep.
Can
I just reach out to some of the people out there that are Jews? It is Passover. This is the first night of Passover. And I just want some of you Jewish parents to know that tonight could be the night that your child's alcoholism begins. I'm just throwing that out there that I remember. You know, that Manischewitz, yeah, go ahead and say, sure, Josh, go ahead. You can just have a little bit. Drink it out of the paper cup. All right? Years later, when they're in a crack house wondering what the hell went wrong with their lives and how could this happen to a good Jewish boy, remember tonight when you say, you can just have a sip, have some of Daddy's, okay? Remember that the possibility, the propensity for young Jewish people to be compulsive, full of guilt, too sensitive, and perhaps a bit obsessive, remember that tonight might be the night that their alcoholism becomes active. All right? So when you say to your 7-year-old, yeah, sure, go ahead, have a sip of Daddy's. That's all I'm saying. All right? And I'm talking from experience on this one. Look, folks, I know a lot happened in the world today, and we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. The White House today angrily denied a report in the Washington Post that suggested President Bush knowingly lied about the existence of biological weapons laboratories in Iraq. Scott McClellan called the story reckless reporting, and when repeatedly pressed by reporters, suggested that if they love Saddam Hussein so much, maybe they should just marry him. After 43 years on the run, Bernardo Provenzano, the alleged boss of all bosses of the Sicilian Mafia, was arrested by Italian police officers in a farmhouse near Corleone. Through his elaborate business and political connections, Provenzano successfully eluded authorities for over 4 decades, in the process wearing out over 100 phony mustaches. Land that was once a home to Ed Gein, the murderer whose story inspired the movie Psycho, was pulled from an online auction on eBay. A fictionalized account of Gein led to the Norman Bates character in Psycho, and still more tragedy when it typecast Tony Perkins for the remainder of his career. And that's the Mark Maron Show's Short Order News for tonight. Now, you want to get back to this energy idea? You want to try and make me understand what the hell you were talking about?
You know, animals can perceive things that we can't perceive. So there must be, there's an underlying current of energy and a life force.
You smell that? I think I'm a little more sensitive to you. I have a heightened, yeah.
You know what you're smelling?
Fear. You don't got to tell me, man.
Yeah, okay.
So you're saying energy, that on some level this could be... now, some things that are...
We
don't have time to go into this, but some things that are primitive, that primitive understandings of things have been sort of religified or mysticalized, and they turn out to be quite true. So what you're saying on some level, this energy could be a scientific explanation for the soul.
It could be. It could have something to do with it, you know, if you believe in the soul.
Yeah, I'm not sure I do. I think that people are unique and they emanate a certain unique energy, as you're saying, but I don't know if that travels anywhere and says, hey, wow, I'm dead, but I'm still okay, and now I'm in another body. I don't know if that happens. I would hate to think that I was someone before, because whatever that poor bastard went through, it certainly didn't get any better with me.
Maybe the person before you just reached the peak.
You want to hear?
And then it's going back down at the bottom again.
Thanks a lot, buddy. Thanks for the
no, I'm just, you know,
mystical optimism.
Did that come out wrong?
You mean you're saying that the guy who was me before probably had a tremendous career, was insanely successful,
was
had everything he wanted, confidence.
Top of the ladder for that guy.
Self-esteem,
and then,
respect in the community. I'm the first step down.
Woo, boom. Right at the bottom of the ladder again.
I'm on my way back to Pigeon. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Hey, look, tomorrow, got a big show from Media Matters. Paul Waldman will be here, and comedian Harlan Williams. You know Harlan? He's goofy. Betty Martini, this is the important one, from Mission Possible International, is going to tell us aspartame is poisoning your brain. Neurological toxin. Lawton Smalls, we're going to get him on the phone. And I want you all to have a good night, sheeple. I hope you enjoyed yourself. Bye, Jim.
Goodbye.